Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Today, is it fact or an outdated stereotype that most rural Australians are opposed to same-sex marriage? This is what Federal Liberal MP Susan Lee had to say about this issue.
I think that it's an idea whose time hasn't quite come in the area of rural Australia and regional Australia that I represent.
Susan Lee represents Western New South Wales. So today we'll assess rural attitudes to gay marriage. Your views are welcome on our Facebook page. Or if you've got a question you want me to put to our guests, at RN Bush Telly if you're on Twitter. Also today, an Australian dairy company's reputation is being questioned in China. Stay with us to find out just how damaging this issue could be for Australian exporters. The newly elected Tasmanian Liberal government is wasting no time in moving to scrap the state's forest peace deal. The Premier-elect, Will Hodgman, is preparing to meet timber industry leaders in the first step towards repealing the Tasmanian Forests Agreement. The agreement between three environmental groups, a range of timber representatives and the union extended the area of protected forests in exchange for millions in industry assistance. The Tasmanian Liberals can only undo the deal with the support of the federal government. Federal Tasmanian Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck is one of the key supporters in Canberra for undoing the agreement. He told me earlier why he is still committed to repealing parts of the World Heritage Area extension.
Basically, because it should never have been put into World Heritage in the first place. We've stated for a considerable period of time since going to have a look at it that significant areas of the extension were logged. The World Heritage Commission themselves said in 2008 that it didn't warrant inclusion into the expanded estate. And that in 2010, Peter Garrett said that the government had no intention to expand the Wilderness World Heritage Area at all. So what we ended up with was a purely political process that was driven by Labor and the Greens at a federal level. Because of that, we got areas put in that shouldn't have been put there.
Why should they not have been put in? This is a process that saw the heritage values independently assessed, and that was led by Professor Jonathan West. You then had the forest industry representatives and environmental groups sit down and reach an agreement and put the area forward for nomination, and then that was accepted by the World Heritage Committee.
Well, that's incorrect. It wasn't assessed by Jonathan West, and that wasn't the job that he had to do. These areas are simply areas that were claimed by the environmental movement.
His job was to assess the conservation values of the area and assess the need for the future timber supply for the industry.
There was no scientific assessment of these areas as part of the nomination process.
So the group looked at the claims the environmental groups were making, compiled a report that was then available to the timber industry representatives that were signatories to this agreement and the environmental groups who then reached an agreement to extend the World Heritage Area.
Well, it's not up to environmental groups and the timber industry to make an agreement about extension of the Wilderness World Heritage Area.
It's up to the World Heritage Committee.
It's not their role. These forests and these areas do not belong to the environment group movement. They do not belong to the timber industry. They don't belong to the unions. They belong to the Australian community more broadly. And it is not the role of the environment movement, the timber industry, or the union movement to make decisions on behalf of government.
What should replace the existing Tasmanian Forests Agreement?
Well, that's something that the new Tasmanian government is going to have to negotiate with the industry, ourselves, and our objective for the forests in Tasmania is that we have, as I've stated, a sustainable industry that provides good forest management, the appropriate forms of forest management in various areas, because you will have different forest management regimes in different parts of the state depending on the local environment and the type of species that you're extracting, and then something that sets it up for a sustainable future into the longer term, and I mean by 100 years plus, so that you can environmentally maintain and sustain the industry and manage the forests for all of their values, whether they be environmental, industrial, forestry, or for community values.
But if an agreement that took 3 years to reach, at least 3 years to reach, is going to be undone, torn up, however you want to put it, and there is a risk that as a result of that you'll see a return to the conflict in the forest, shouldn't there be a clear plan in place of what will replace that agreement?
Well, there is a clear plan in place for what will replace it. It was written in our policy at the federal election. We will return to the framework of the regional forest agreements, which sets down strong forest management systems, which sets down a sustainable yield for harvest of forest and regeneration of forests, and for protection of the environment.
So what role, if any, should the ENGOs, the big environment groups that have been signatories to the previous agreement, what role should they play in determining the future of Tasmania's forest industry?
Well, the first thing that the environmental groups need to do is to listen to what the Tasmanian community have said. The Tasmanian community, as much as anyone else, want to see their forests sustainably managed. That can happen. I've had a number of conversations with the environmental groups that have been party to the negotiations. They understand very much our perspectives from a federal view. They understand that we want to have a sustainable industry that looks after the environment, and there was actually a real opportunity to do that with guns leaving the industry, to reduce the intensity of harvest, to extend our rotations, providing a higher quality timber resource, which would have given a community benefit, an environmental benefit, and also an industry benefit. But they weren't prepared to listen to that. They wanted it all their own way, which has been the problem all along. And I can tell you, this government, and I'm sure the Tasmanian government, will not be blackmailed by environmental groups who just want it all their own way, nor will we be blackmailed by the Greens, who want to see the end of the native forest industry in Australia, not just Tasmania, because that's their stated policy.
This program was in Tasmania last week, looking at this issue, and it was made very clear by Vicar Bailey and others that if the existing agreement is wound back or repealed, then there is a risk of return to the forest conflicts. And we also heard from Dr. Jackie Sherman from the University of Canberra, who's studied this extensively, that having the environmental groups on site and endorsing the future of Tasmania's forestry is essential if the industry is to have markets going forward, to have high-value markets going forward. Don't you have to, as a Liberal Party and the state Liberals, have to work with the environmental movement?
Yes, we do. And I've, as I've said, met with the environment movement on any time that they've knocked on my door to come and have a discussion. Always been prepared to do that. But I'm not going to be blackmailed by people like Vicar Bailey. His view is not the only view of the world. He needs to respect the view of the Tasmanian people. And that's something that he needs to clearly understand. We will sit down and work out a process whereby the industry in Tasmania has a sustainable future that provides benefits for the community, it provides benefits for the environment, and it provides benefit for the industry. That can very well be done. It's actually demonstrated by the fact that significant areas within the New Wilderness World Heritage boundary have been significantly logged. The Greens claim that they can be regenerated, which is an endorsement of the forest management practices in Tasmania, and I actually agree with them, they can be regenerated, which demonstrates that there is no need to lock all these areas up. We need to manage them well so that we get a result for the environment, the community, and for the industry.
How important do you think an independent third-party certification for the industry's products will be to the future of the industry?
Well, we already have one independent third-party certification system in the Australian Forestry Standard, which is globally benchmarked to PEFC, and there is work being undertaken for the development of a Forest Stewardship Council standard here in Australia, which I fully support. And both of those are important to different elements of the market globally. In fact, I've had that very conversation with Forest Stewardship Council and their board.
If the extension to the World Heritage Area is partially repealed, there is a risk that there'll be some areas of native forest that will be available for logging again, and that in turn will put at risk any Forest Stewardship Council certification. How will you overcome that?
Well, the environmental groups don't have a veto over Forest Stewardship Council certification. They might claim they do, but they don't. The Forest Stewardship Council and any certification system is a system of assessment and measurement of the forest management practices that occur in any particular forest that are covered by those systems.
And if more forest is opened up for logging, then that assessment is at risk. That certification is at risk.
Well, not necessarily. I don't think you actually understand how it works. What the Forest Stewardship certification was actually designed for native forest logging. It came out of Canada and was designed for native forest logging. And so it doesn't prohibit native forest logging, and that's, I think, a misnomer that the green groups have put around as part of their marketing campaign against the forest industry, particularly the native forest industry. And forest stewardship certification doesn't prohibit harvesting in a native forest, but what it talks about is the way that you go about that, and it checks your forest management practices against the certification system to assess that you're doing what you say that you're doing. And it's the forest management practices that are very, very important to the gaining of Forest Stewardship Council certification, as it is with the Australian Forestry Standard.
The single biggest timber operator in the state, and some say the most important, Tar Ann, and also the head of the Forest Industries Association, Terry Edwards, have both asked for the existing agreement to remain in place. Why won't you listen to them?
Well, industry doesn't design government policy. I know that's what we're often accused of, but the Tar Ann know what our policy is. I've spoken to them recently, and I've spoken to Terry Edwards recently. They understand our policy. Our policy is about providing a sustainable timber supply for a sustainable industry into the long-term future.
But these are people who know what the industry needs. They're right there at the forefront.
Excuse me for knowing my policy, but I can tell you, because I've looked at the supply charts for this industry that were done by Jonathan West, and the Tasmanian Forest Agreement leaves the Tasmanian forest industry without a timber supply by 2030. Now, that leaves a future government in the situation of having to mop up a complete mess when that timber supply runs out. And I am not going to put a future government into the situation that I've inherited from the previous government, which is to clean up a significant mess that's been left in Tasmania.
Tasmanian Liberal Senator Richard Colbeck, you're listening to Bush Telegraph. Tasmania's timber industry wants independent certification of its environmental credentials, and this is so its product can be sold and marketed as sustainable. One of the groups tasked with assessing the sustainability of logging is the Forest Stewardship Council, and Michael Spencer was the founding chief executive of FSC Australia. He held that position until 2011, and he's now a consultant. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Good. What's your view on the Tasmanian state government's pledge to do away with the Forests Agreement?
Well, I guess there's two elements to it. One is I think it brings an unnecessary level of confrontation into forest policy. So we're sort of turning the clock back to a confrontational approach. If you read the policy, it's about ripping up agreements and increasing penalties for people who might protest against forestry activities and changing the law for anyone who might speak to markets about forest activities. And I think that's really an unnecessary level of confrontation at a point in time when there is the potential to move this forward in a more constructive way, which is really the key to long-term security of the industry. It's how do you reach a consensus around forest management?
Why should the industry, the timber industry itself, be concerned if the agreement is done away with, repealed?
I was listening to the senator. I think where we're starting from on industry policy at the moment, if you go back to what the Prime Minister said about the SPC situation a few weeks ago, you know, if we're at the end of the age of entitlement and industries need to look after themselves, then in a sense this is what the Tasmanian industry has been doing. And yet another part of government comes along and says, no, we don't like what you're doing. We're going to change all that. And so I think, you know, there's this consistent application of industry policy that in the long term is going to cause confusion and problems. From an FSC certification point of view, and as you rightly noted, I've been out of that for a couple of years now, you've got the potential for the escalation of community conflict. And community relations is a part of FSC certification. So if we see a return to the days of old of conflict in the forests, then I think, you know, that's going to be a problem before you even get into high conservation values and the others that may be affected.
So you think that repealing the agreement potentially puts FSC certification at risk?
Well, it's important to note the two processes are completely different. So the agreement wasn't an essential part of getting FSC certification. Equally, not having an agreement doesn't preclude it. What I'm saying, though, is that you're moving in the wrong direction, bearing in mind the community relations elements of FSC. I mean, when guns first came to FSC, when I was the CEO, one of the things we did, and I think Forestry Tasmania has acknowledged this, is we had to go around to the staff, and I was part of this, and say, well, what does this mean for how you work and how you relate to stakeholders and this sort of thing? And I think that was very valuable in changing, or I guess recalibrating the mindset in terms of how they deal with their stakeholders. And I think, this is part of the process Forestry Tasmania has just started. So you've got to ask yourself, well, what signals does this new policy send the staff at Forestry Tasmania about how things are going to be done in future? And I think it's sending the wrong message.
But if the end of this agreement, if it signals a return to the protests in the forests, but the Tasmanian timber industry still obtains the necessary certification to prove it's sustainable, third-party certification, then surely the market effect will be minimal. The industry can still go to the market and say, look, we're doing the right thing.
Well, one of the things you need to appreciate is there's no market pressure for this change that the Senator was just talking about. The 90% of wood that comes out of Tasmanian native forests is chip. The wood chip market is oversupplied at the moment. You know, before the global financial crisis, the prices were around $2,009, $2,010 a ton. They're down as low as $130 a ton. So why, as an element of your industry policy, are you going to rush into creating additional supply that doesn't have a market? And if it did, it could have a perverse effect on the rest of the industry, which is to lower the price. So there's no need to for this sort of, what I term the sort of Vladimir Putin approach to industry policy. We really need to be moving towards a consensus and finding a way forward. And I think there are elements of that in what the Senator said. I mean, I think he acknowledged the importance of understanding all the values that the forests offer the community. And I think that's a good starting point, because it says, instead of saying, which was one of his other comments, we're going to go and talk to the industry, the starting point is to say, what do these forests mean to all elements of the Tasmanian community? Not just the logging industry, but what does it mean to the beekeepers, to the tourism providers, to people who use the water, to biodiversity, and all these other elements? And then how do we manage the forests so as to get the best outcome for the whole community? I think that's going to be a much better way.
It's hard to argue with Richard Colbeck or Will Hodgman when they say they have a mandate for this change, though, isn't it? It's been to two elections now, and as they point out, the Tasmanian people have voted overwhelmingly to repeal the agreement.
I think that's a simplistic argument that really abrogates the leadership we expect from politicians. Nobody goes into a polling booth on election day with a tick sheet that says, which policies do you agree with and which policies do you disagree with? What people go into the booth doing on election day is to say, we think this mob's got a better chance than the other mob at providing us with a better future. And that's the fundamental obligation, is how do we manage this in order to provide a better future for Tasmanians? And the route they're going down at the moment has the potential to have the opposite effect. A more divided Tasmania isn't a healthy Tasmania. An industry that depends on subsidised wood from public forests and subsidised downstream users of that wood isn't in the Tasmanian community's public interest. So we've got to really step back from the confrontation and say, what is good public policy here?
Michael, nice to get your thoughts. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Michael Spencer was the founding chief executive of the Forest Stewardship Council in Australia. He held that position until 2011, and he's now a consultant. You're listening to RN and Radio Australia. This is Bush Telegraph. Tony Allen's joining me with today's National Rural News. Given the discussion we were just having, this is a fitting place to start. Tony, the federal government is preparing, or putting the all the cards in the right place for Cut Red Tape Day.
Yes, Wednesday of next week, I believe, is a repeal day when a whole lot of legislation will be voted on to cut red tape across the federal government's operations. And today some of the legislation is being reduced. I'll run through a couple of interesting things. One is that the government is trying to repeal laws that were due to come into place in July that Labor had introduced. These were to require companies to periodically re-register farm and vet chemicals to prove that they remain safe to use. Now, supporters of the changes said this would make sure products remain safe for humans, animals and the environment, but the coalition at the time argued, along with farm groups and chemical companies, that this was just a whole lot of red tape that would cost up to $8 million extra a year. Mm-hmm. So they're going to try and repeal that. It may come into trouble in the Senate, as will the Future of Financial Advice Act. Now, this has had a lot of publicity. This is about easing restrictions on financial advisors by repealing an act that Labor introduced last year to protect consumers from bad financial advice in various ways. Now, rural valuer Sam Payton, whom we've been speaking to, says there is a risk here that it might ease restrictions on advice about managed investment schemes, many of which collapsed and left farm investors out of pocket. Sam Payton says that it could see the returns of commissions for advisors who are promoting these agribusiness schemes as tax breaks.
Great Southern Timber Corp, Rewards Group, and a couple of other grape schemes, they all went the way they did because the fundamental underlying economics was flawed, whereby commission-fed advice, which had no relationship to the viability of the project, just led to this gold rush of investment.
Okay, I hadn't made that link between the changes in the financial rules and the managed investment schemes. There's something controversial going ahead in Victoria. What's taking place?
Well, there's long been a debate in Victoria about whether kangaroo meat processing should be allowed. And finally, the Victorian government has agreed to a two-year trial, of processing eastern and western grey kangaroos. There's no shortage of them in Victoria. Some are already culled under wildlife control programs. So the government is going to allow that to be turned into commercial pet food, not human food, at abattoirs. Mm-hmm. The Agriculture Minister, Peter Walsh, says the trial is going to address some of the problems about what to do with disposing of the kangaroos that have already been culled.
This is about utilising the carcasses that are currently there following a cull under a wildlife control permit. Currently they are supposed to be buried. Probably not everyone does bury them. So it's an opportunity to utilise carcasses as are available. It's not about growing a kangaroo harvest industry.
Okay. So going into pet
being
food.
Very cautious there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's a plague fish that's been found in what were thought to be pristine waters in Queensland. What's been found?
Well, minnows, you would think, are pretty harmless, but if you give it the name plague minnows, you know, it might be a bit of a problem. This fish was originally introduced to Australia from America to control the mosquito population. You can see how successful that was. It's spread through a lot of rivers in Australia, but it has now been discovered in the Leichhardt River in northwest Queensland. Now, this is one of the country's last remaining, or was one of the last remaining, pest-free river systems. So the ecologists are very worried that this is going to devastate the native fish populations in northwest Queensland. Environmental worker Mick Brady says the plague minnow, even though it's not very big, will attack larger native species.
Any pest animal, really, or pest or weed species can be a problem just because they outcompete native animals for food and habitat. This particular fish is really aggressive. They say they bite the fins of natives. They can eat the eggs of native fish, and it upsets just the whole ecology of the area.
And they reckon there's little hope of eradicating it.
So brought here to eat mozzies, and it attacks native fish. That's not the intended consequence, clearly.
The aquatic cane toad, perhaps.
Yeah, sounds that way, doesn't it? All right, thanks, Tony. We'll leave it there. Tony Allen with today's National Rural News. Cameron Wilson with you. You're listening to Bush Telegraph around Australia on RN. And across Asia and the Pacific, you're listening to Radio Australia. The issue of gay marriage was brought up again on ABC TV's Q&A program on Monday night.
An audience member asked why it was not legalised, and on the panel was Assistant Minister for Education Susan Lee. Here's what she said.
We all seem to agree, then why isn't gay marriage legalised?
Do you want to jump in on that one, Susan?
I think that it's an idea whose time hasn't quite come in the area of rural Australia and regional Australia that I represent.
That was Susan Lee, who's the Assistant Minister for Education and member for Ferro, which takes in western New South Wales, a large area north of the Murray River. We thought we'd put this assertion to the test. National Director of Australian Marriage Equity, Rodney Croom, commissioned a Galaxy poll to determine what the level of support for gay marriage is. Rodney, thank you for joining Bush Telegraph.
Hi, Cameron. Thanks for having me on.
Is gay marriage unpopular in regional Australia?
No, not at all. According to the Galaxy poll you just mentioned, the national support for marriage equality is about 64-65%. And support in regional and rural Australia is 60%, so just a few percentage points behind, and it's still obviously a majority. So in my view, I think there is majority support in regional and rural Australia, including in Susan Lee's electorate. Another poll from News Poll found that support there was about 56-57%. So it's pretty consistent across the country, no matter where you live.
I should point out that we invited Susan Lee to come on the program. She was not available today, but her website quotes a Roy Morgan research, a Roy Morgan poll, that says in her electorate, 29% of Australians say that homosexuality is immoral. Now, Susan goes on to say that I vigorously disagree with the assessment in terms of the rights and the recognition of same-sex couples should have. So we're not saying she endorses that. But if that poll is correct, then she's on the money, isn't she, when she says her electorate is not ready for the change?
No, I don't think so. It's only 29%, like you said.
Yes, but 29% saying it's immoral. The question's not around support for same-sex marriage. If almost 30% say immoral, you could assume that there may be a larger proportion that oppose same-sex marriage.
Well, like I said, the news poll that took in her electorate on this issue of marriage equality found that about 40% opposed marriage equality, and that would include the 29% who thinks it's immoral. But there's still a majority of people in that very electorate, which, as you said, is far western New South Wales and along the Murray River there, where a majority of people support this reform. And that doesn't come as a surprise to me, because I grew up in rural Tasmania on the northwest coast, and all of my family are dairy farmers, my very large extended family, and I don't find any opposition to this reform in that family or amongst my parents or uncles and aunties' friends. I think there's a sense in rural Australia that this reform is about things that are important, like family, like community, like tradition, and that gay people have as much place in those values as everyone else.
Why do you think there is this stereotype for some that endures that it's rural Australia that opposes this change?
It's an urban myth. I think that there are people in the middle of Sydney and Melbourne who like the idea that they're morally superior because they support this reform, and use it as a kind of way to make themselves feel better and look at the country and think, well, you know, they're just a bunch of rednecks out there. But that is a stereotype. In the same way that there are stereotypes of gay people, there are stereotypes of rural people. And if you look at the figures that I've quoted already, those stereotypes are complete nonsense. Mm. Like I said, that's not my experience in rural Tasmania, and I don't think it's the experience in rural New South Wales. Susan Lee, of course, is entitled to her view, but I wonder whether it's just a convenient excuse for her at this stage, when it's maybe a bit hard for her at the moment to come out in support for this because of the leadership of the Liberal Party or whatever, and she's using her electorate as an excuse, but I'm afraid it's not.
Rodney Croom is the National Director of Australian Marriage Equality. Let's see what the experience is in rural New South Wales. Katrina Crocker is in a same-sex relationship living in Wagga Wagga. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, what's been your experience living in Wagga Wagga? How accepting has the community been of your relationship?
We have a very positive we have never had really any trouble here in Wagga from my own personal experience. In fact, we are very well accepted, and We've never really had too much of experience with any negativity. We've certainly encountered pockets of conservatism, but with recent events last year, Fred Nile came to Wagga and had a rally, as a rule, the Wagga people were very unhappy with that, and the difference on that day between a marriage equality rally and the support and that the Main Street showed was chalk and cheese. So that's been my experience.
I should point out, Wagga is not in Susan Lee's electorate, but it neighbours it. Michael McCormick's your local member from the Nationals. Katrina, you had a failed marriage attempt.
Yes, we did. I don't like to. I don't like to call it that. But Mandy and myself got married in Canberra, in our small window of opportunity on the 7th of December.
You were two of the Canberra 31, were you?
Yes, we were. Yes, we were. We had a wonderful day, and we actually came back to Wagga and had our reception at a local restaurant. Which they couldn't have gone out of their... They went out of their way to accommodate us and make sure that it was all ready for us, obviously, because we were travelling, etc. We didn't actually have a separate area. We were in the restaurant, and we actually had well wishes come up from people that we didn't know and wish us well and also wish us well on the High Court ruling.
Is that typical of the response you got locally when you told people you'd got married?
Very much so. I do understand that obviously I'm talking about people that I know and my friendships, etc., but I've never had a negative response from my work colleagues, from any of the areas that I certainly come in contact with. I've never walked down the street with my partner and encountered any negativity or in fact anybody come up but offer some support no matter where we were.
That's Katrina Crocker, who is in a same-sex relationship living in Wagga Wagga in New South Wales. Now also with me is Robert Brokenshire. Robert's an MLC with Family First in South Australia. Hi Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hello Cameron, good to talk to you.
How would you describe the attitude towards same-sex marriage in rural South Australia?
Well, when it comes to the general acceptance and understanding of same-sex situations, I think country South Australia would have a similar view to the acceptance, the tolerance and the care for those people as they do for anybody else. But when it comes to marriage, my assessment travelling across the state regularly as a legislative councillor is that depends how the question is asked, but I think most people in the the majority of people in the country would be still wanting to support traditional values. So I don't think that Susan Lee is necessarily out of step with a lot of other people, but obviously there is a big strong push across the nation for equality with same-sex marriage, and there's differing views in the country too, Cameron.
Mm. So I should say you're a dairy farmer as well, Robert, and you're regionally based. Whereabouts?
I am a dairy farmer. My family farm on the Fleurieu Peninsula, which is a little town called Mount Compass down towards Victor Harbour. And, of course, we've got probably an even more diverse community here because we do have green change and sea change people that have come from the city that want to enjoy rural lifestyle and the higher rainfall and the nice coast. So we've got quite a divergence of people right across the spectrum here in the Fleurieu Peninsula.
Mm. Okay, so your opinion is predominantly based on the interaction you have with the people in your electorate rather than polling?
Oh, that's right. I mean, look, well, Family First haven't gone out and done any polling, and, that's the first time I've heard about a poll specific to country views on this. But I just think, country people probably are a little more careful in a lot of areas as against people in the city when it goes to a range of views and modernisation, if I can put it that way. And, I think at the moment that if you said to people, well, what do you really want the focus to be on, traditional values and traditional marriage or same-sex marriage, I think probably at the moment the majority of people would still say, well, let's focus on traditional values and traditional marriage. And it depends how the question is put, Cameron. But, you know, I mean, maybe we are a little more conservative in the country, but I personally don't see that as a bad thing. Mm. And there are a lot of people in the city who, you know, sometimes scared to talk for the fear of being told that they're not politically correct.
Is there a chance, though, as a family first representative, that maybe the functions you attend are the crowd there is perhaps more traditional in its views, and they are the views that you hear the majority of?
Well, that's a good question, and there would be some argument for that. But of course, Family First is a broad party, and you know I'm all over the state at everything from mining versus farming meeting to the River Murray issues, to drought relief, to better commodity prices and, you know, dairy summits, you name it. So I really get to meet an incredibly broad range of people from country South Australia and from our bigger regions. Mm. So I'm just giving you what I see as an honest assessment on all those people that I meet across the state.
How often are you challenged on that view?
Say that again?
How often are you challenged on that view?
Not that often. I mean, I've got friends that I work with and acquaintances and professional acquaintances in politics and in government agencies that are, you know, they're gay or lesbian, and some of them now and again raise the issue of same-sex marriage. But I'd have to say that over a very long period of time, and, you know, former police minister where I met with a broad cross-section of different agency people, and I really had very few of those people that we're in a same-sex relationship asking for same-sex marriage equality.
Robert Brokenshire is from Family First in South Australia on Bush Telegraph. We're discussing attitudes to same-sex marriage and questioning whether the attitude is different in rural Australia than it is in the big cities of this country. Rodney Croom is still with me, the National Director of Australian Marriage Equality. Rodney, if it's not location, geographic location, that determines people's attitudes on this issue, what do you think it is?
Well, according to the polls, Cameron, it's as you said, it's not really location. It's also not gender. Men support this only a few percentage points less than women. Tends not to be background. Blue and white collar workers seem to have the same level of support, or just about the same. If there's a difference demographically, it's age. While a thin majority of a bare majority of older Australians support it, a whopping majority of young Australians support it, up to 80-85% if you talk about people aged 18 to 25. And it's only a few percentage points behind for people under 35. So it's really an age issue. And I think that's two things. Firstly, older people may be less familiar with same-sex couples. They may not have grown up with same-sex couples, and they may not have seen that those relationships are the same as their own relationships, and they might have a different understanding of marriage too. I mean, if you got married in the 50s and you got married in church and living together was still a sin and all those kinds of things, then you might find it harder to adjust to the idea of same-sex couples getting married. But again, from my experience, some of the strongest supporters of marriage equality in my farming family are the older members, because they know what really matters, and what matters to them are the traditional values that Robert was just talking about, values like family and community and tradition, and they're so important that they want me and my partner and other gay couples included within those values and traditions. They're conservative people, but it doesn't mean that they oppose marriage equality. In fact, it's a reason they support it.
Throughout the research you've had commissioned, are there any electorates, rural electorates, that really stand out as being significantly different than the national trends?
No. Not any of the rural or regional electorates. Where marriage equality support tends to be the lowest is in Western Sydney and in southwest Brisbane. So there's still a majority support there, but it's probably lower than the rest of the country. So again, this isn't about urban-rural. Support would be higher, for instance, in Susan Ley's electorate of Farrer than in some electorates in Western Sydney. Why that is the case, I really don't understand. I wish I did. But that tends to be where support is lowest. Again, I live in Hobart, so I'm most familiar with the Tasmanian situation. Mm-hmm. And if you compare Denison, which is Hobart City, to, say, Lyons, which is takes in a lot of rural Tasmania, the support isn't very much different. It's pretty consistent across Tasmania from country to city. So that's not really the defining factor.
Katrina Crocker, I wonder if you're expecting or preparing to get married a second time in your lifetime, maybe next time in Wagga Wagga.
Well, certainly that's exactly what we hope for, and why we've probably become more active since we got married over in Canberra and had the annulment than we have ever been in our life. I mean, I just like to add to what they said about the country in terms of people coming up or people having an opinion about marriage equality. My opinion on that, and from talking to people, particularly in my region, is that most people, unless they have some vested interest in an issue, will rarely say anything, because country people don't tend to do that. That does not mean that they're for or against an issue. It just has to become personal for them before they say anything. So you know, quite often get a vocal minority having their say, particularly in these kinds of issues.
Katrina, nice talking to you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Katrina Crocker, who is in a same-sex relationship. Katrina lives in Wagga Wagga. Robert, thank you to you as well. Robert Brokenshire is an MLC in South Australia with Family First. And Rodney Croom, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it. Rodney's the National Director of Australian Marriage Equality. Some of your views that have been coming in on social media, facebook.com/bushtelegraph. Sue, I live in regional New South Wales and I'm definitely ready. I have no plans to ever get married, but each to their own. At least I have a choice and everyone should be given the same choice, same sex or not. Sheena says, posing the question, is an insult and divisive. Rural and remote electorates have little influence amongst the city millions. And Benjamin says that basically that rural people have bigger things to worry about. Rural Australians are struggling to protect their land and water from state mining. If gay marriage is a bigger issue for regional Australians than their ability to live in regional Australia, then we are deservedly doomed as people. You can share your views by going to facebook.com/bushtelegraph, or you can find us at RNBushTele on Twitter. There's a few views coming in there as well. I'll endeavour to get to them later on in the program. This is Bush Telegraph on RN. Australia's image in China has been tarnished somewhat after a TV station there broadcast claims that an Australian dairy company mislabeled tins of infant formula. The TV program said nearly 20,000 cans of the formula had conflicting use-by dates, which appear to have been extended by a year. The producer of the formula, Oz Dairy, which is based in Dandenong in Victoria, told ABC's Late Line last night that this was an innocent error which led to mislabeling and that the formula was not out of date. But the fact that such a, what seems like a relatively small issue has gained such media attention highlights the sensitivities of Chinese consumers to any food safety issues, particularly if infant formula is involved. Steve Spencer is a food market analyst. His company, Fresh Agenda, has a strong presence in the dairy industry. Nice to have you back on the program, Steve.
Thank you.
What do you make of this particular issue? Is this a storm in the teacup, or is it really a concern for Australian exporters to China?
I think this episode will eventually be seen as a storm in a teacup. It doesn't mean the vigilance and the need for accuracy and precision in what occurs in the supply chain after milk, you know, is processed and turned into product and reaches the market. It doesn't mean that precision shouldn't let up, because there's an extremely vigilant set of regulators in China aimed at cleaning up their dairy market, and this is part of what's going on.
The Australian industry has been one of the big beneficiaries from food scares or mislabeling in other industries. Surely, if anything like that is to happen in our sector, then the consequences could be huge.
Yeah, that's right. We can't afford mistakes. Certainly, if one of the major players had a systematic problem that was picked up of this nature, then we'd have some real problems. Now, we have to say that several countries exporting, or the suppliers from several countries exporting to China, have had a similar issue in recent times. So it's affected some New Zealand product, which got mislabeled. It's affected European product at this same time as this one was announced. Mm. So it's simply an increasingly stringent examination of the detail in China that's picking up these mistakes, and they're probably there, you know, in the background most of the time.
Mm. But if you're going to have the integrity of a product questioned, infant formula is about the worst one, isn't it, to be in question?
You won't get any higher. That's right. You won't get any higher vigilance because of the importance of children to the Chinese families, and therefore that flows right up to the extent of scrutiny in this product area, because the products are, you know, higher priced. These are premium products, and we've seen the past examples where children died when there was a tainting of product by the use of chemicals several years ago.
The melamine scare that was so well publicised.
That's right.
Australia's Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce has said that the Chinese market for dairy could increase by as much as 1,000% in the years ahead. Does an issue like that put any of these forecasts in doubt?
No, I don't think China's got an inherent shortage, which is going to be maintained for what we'd all expect to be at least the medium term. it has a rampant market where millions of new consumers are being added into the middle class each year, demanding more nutritious product, demanding, you know, the higher priced product, or the product with higher integrity to feed their children. But their dairy industry, at the same time as that demand escalating, is actually short of, you know, considerably short of product. They've got a shrinkage in milk output, and they've got a restructuring of their supply chain being undertaken by the government, which is trying to kick out the small, unsafe players and ensure that the market is supplied by reliable importers or reliable local players.
Earlier in this week, we were chatting with a couple of exporters, Australian-based exporters, sending dairy products to China. One of them was air freighting milk into Shanghai at $8 a litre. We thought that was incredible at the time, until someone on Twitter, at RN Bushtelli, pointed out that in New Zealand there were reports of $23 being paid for 2 litres. But it's incredible, isn't it, when you think of those figures. But given the importance of this market, how critical is Australia's clean and green image, and what does this latest scrutiny tell you about how far the obligations extend if that image is to be maintained?
I think it's a very good question. certainly clean and green, but I think it's clean and green. Clean is the important word here. It's the respect that our supply chain has got in a country like China, because of the extent of quality and safety regulation we have in our industry here. That's what carries us into that market, and that's what the Chinese importers are particularly keen on. Now, we've got competitors with similar credentials, but when you line up against what the experience has been from the Chinese industry itself, that's why people are prepared to pay big bucks for, you know, imported product from a country like Australia, because of that integrity. And that's something it's everyone in the supply chain that has to respect that, and it is of vital importance if we're going to get better prices available out of the world market in future.
So what steps do you think the industry needs to put in place to protect its image in the future?
Well, I think it's pretty much got all the steps it needs. I think the issues that come up like this are the ones that occur in market, effectively beyond, you know, where we might even lose control of a product when it's sold into another market. We have to actually ensure that there's nothing going on tampering or mislabeling or even rebranding product, which has occurred in the past. So that'll mean some in-market presence to ensure that, you know, the product on the shelf is what it should be. Now that may take a bit more investment, but it certainly, I think in the future, if we're going to hold this sort of market and hold those premiums, that's the sort of thing we should be doing.
Thanks for joining us, Steve. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Steve Spencer is a food market analyst. His company is Fresh Agenda. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. A bush cricket competition continues to give farmers on the Liverpool Plains in northern New South Wales a break from their drought-affected farming duties. The annual midweek Prima and District Cricket Comp has been going for about 25 years now. Lisa Herbert took to the field at Spring Ridge, minus a helmet, which she soon regretted.
It's late on a Wednesday afternoon, and there's something a little bit different about the cricket match that I'm at. There are a couple of beers sitting by the stumps over there, and most of the players remain in their work gear, straight from the farm, boots and all. The beer hasn't come too far. The sports ground at Spring Ridge is just a few hundred metres from the only pub in this small town. Seven teams play in this region's comp. Most of the guys make a living from the land, and a few hours of midweek bush cricket takes them away from some tough, long days on the farm.
You better go back to the land.
Yes, Johnny.
This is going to be the most dangerous interview I've ever done. G'day, Nick.
Hey, Lisa. How you going?
Not too bad. Can I stand with you at the crease?
Yeah, you're right. Just watch the balls coming back.
What's the score so far? What are you on?
I think we're 4 for probably 50-odd. Which is not the best situation to be in, but...
How often do you do this?
Every Wednesday, in January through March. Good running, boys, good running. We usually play seven aside, so there's usually 14 people here. Not many supporters. Oh, it depends, sometimes you get a few people. And Johnny? Oh, it was brought in probably 20 years ago, just an excuse for the farmers to get together and relax and have a few beers. And daylight saving. Plenty of time to play till 7:30.
Not everyone playing is in runners or cricket shoes. There's a few boots around.
Yeah, well, some people have come straight off the tractor and straight off the spray rig. So, yeah, it's just whatever you come in, you come in.
How serious does it get?
This is the local derby, so it's friendly banter. But, yeah, some teams take it pretty seriously. But between us two, it's pretty good fun.
That was bold. Out.
Put your bat in front of the stump!
Hi, I'm Dave. I don't know how many runs around Lisa. They tell you have to retire at 30. I think I've run 45.
What role does this game play every Wednesday afternoon?
It gets us off the farm. Have a bloody good time. We otherwise we're on our own, really.
All right, who's this bowler?
Ben Clift. He's old like me.
So where should I stand? Are you going to hit this one or not?
I'd stand at first slip. I'll hit your catch. It's over there next to this bloke with the gloves. Okay?
All right.
She's not taking my advice.
Okay, I've left the wicket. Moving to, I don't know, is this third man? Where are you?
One of my cow corner.
Why do you play this game?
Oh, I'm on a family farm here, so I just, this Dave's my uncle actually. Mm-hmm. So I've just come in and help out, and whenever they need someone, I just come and play. So it's been pretty good.
David Brownhill just got a six over my head. Yeah. It's been played over the years in all sorts of seasons. This might be one of the worst.
It is. So I've got some photos, and I'll give them to you of Mullally a couple of weeks ago. It's on the actual field's on the stock route, and it was just bare dirt, completely bare dirt, and all there is a cement green strip in the middle, and it's just cement. There's no matting. Like at least spring, nearly all the fields now got matting. Blackwell's just got brand new matting, and that field's at the school. But it's just good for the community. That's really what it's all about.
We hear a lot of mental health and maintaining it as best you can in all sorts of seasons, and the experts say exercise and also social interaction is great for that. So you're hitting, I hate to use a cliche, but you're scoring two runs with that.
Yeah, exactly, and it is good, and we're lucky here. Like, it was dry, it didn't rain for a couple of months, or nearly 3 months. But, you know, clearly there's obviously people elsewhere that are still dry and a lot drier. And we didn't get a lot of rain to really make a big difference yet, but it's better than nothing.
What kind of improvements have you seen in the players, both socially and with their skills base?
I don't think we've had any improvement in performance. Sometimes the performance begins at 8:30 when the sun goes down, and there's generally fairly good, solid competition around that, responsibly, of course. But it's just good fun. Like the bloke out here batting now, he's the only person in the entire competition that bats with two pads, two gloves and a helmet. There is no one else who does that. If you look at the bloke at the other end, he's got one pad on and a cap, no gloves. So Mark's very conscious of his health, I guess. And he's old. He's the oldest player. Actually, he's very old.
He's actually got a few runs too, so it's paying off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he thinks he's good as well. I mean, he's actually quite good.
Dave Brownhill ending that report by Lisa Herbert. Some noisy birds on that cricket oval. For the record, Burrendong beat Yarraman by 3 runs. That's us done for today. There's a couple more comments coming in about rural attitudes to gay marriage. I'll give Julian's one and I'll read that out for you. I think she, being Susan Lee, is demeaning the intelligence and compassion of her electorate. There's plenty more there. Go to @RNBushTally if you want to see them for yourself. Stay on RN now. We've got the news next. That will be followed by The World Today. Cameron Wilson's one. I'll see you at the same time tomorrow.